I am pleased to have the honor to introduce today's speaker, Fred Rosenbaum. Fred is the founding director of Later House Judaica, the largest adult Jewish education center in the Western United States. He received a Bachelor of Arts from Washington University in St. Louis, graduating summa cum laude, and he holds a master's degree in history from the University of California at Berkeley. I think maybe that's where we met, Fred, where he specialized in modern and contemporary history. He's been a faculty member of the University of San Francisco, San Francisco State, and the Graduate Theological Union, GTU, in Berkeley. He's also written 3 books and numerous articles on modern Jewish history. As a journalist, he traveled to Eastern Europe, where he reported on the collapse of communism in Prague, Berlin, Budapest, and in Warsaw, Poland. He has received many awards, including the S.Y. Agnon Gold Medal for Intellectual Excellence and the Award for Exceptional Jewish Educators from the Covenant Foundation in New York. Fred has also held Ford, Fulbright, and Woodrow Wilson fellowships. The history of the Jews of San Francisco and, to a lesser degree, the East Bay can be traced to a time prior to 1850. Fred Rosenbaum has studied and written about those families that rose to prominence following the Gold Rush. Familiar names like Schloss, Zellerbach, Lilienthal, and Fleischacker are names that Fred wrote about in his book, Architects of Reform. And in this book, he describes the feelings of freedom and social and political acceptance, and perhaps the greatest feelings of freedom for Jews anywhere else in the world. His next book is entitled Cosmopolitans. It's a social and cultural history of the Jews of the Bay Area. And by the way, this book is being published by the UC Press. Tonight, Fred Rosenbaum will concentrate on Bay Area Jewish life in the period of 1945 to the present, in keeping with the theme of the Now and Then series. In an article many years ago in the New York Times, Perry Garfinkel wrote that as recently as 1950, the San Francisco Bay Area was considered a backwater of American Judaism, with only about 2.5% of the population identified as Jews. So there is certainly much more to tell about this story, and I am pleased to introduce the perfect person to tell it to us. Please welcome Fred Rosenbaum.
Okay. Thank you very much, Joe. Appreciate that. As Joe mentioned, this talk is part of a series entitled Now and Then about the myriad changes since 1945. And certainly, the decade of the 1940s is the pivot of Bay Area Jewish life. 1940s, the pivot. 1840s is the beginning of it. But the turning point, not just for the history of California, but the history of the Jews in the Bay Area, is a century later, the 1940s. In addition to the war and, of course, the attendant social changes, Jews had to confront the two most convulsive Jewish events in 2,000 years, the Holocaust and the creation of Israel. In the Bay Area, was also that the mid-1940s was the beginning of a demographic watershed, and Joe began to allude to that. 1945, the Bay Area did not even rank in the top 10 largest American Jewish communities. Today, with about 425,000 Jews, it is tied with South Florida as the third largest in the country, and the sixth largest in the entire world. So I welcome the chance to analyze the changes since the war. But first we must ask, what was the Jewish community like by 1945, near the end of the first century? We may say that it was an exception among American Jewish communities, even very different than Los Angeles. Now, I titled my book The Cosmopolitans, my forthcoming book, to capture the unique essence of that Jewish community. Artistically creative, economically powerful, philanthropic and civic-minded, borrowing freely from other traditions, interacting fully with non-Jews. In short, was a community by 1945 much more universalist than particularist. It was dominated by German Jewish families with roots in the gold rush. They have a stellar record of accomplishment, but it's also true that they looked down on the East European Jews who were coming by the turn of the century. They actually discouraged them from settling in the Bay Area. The leading families were so concerned about the crime and disease and poverty in the south of Market area. That was the first settlement of East European Jews. They actually proposed to buy Baja California from the Mexican government and settle the East European Jews there. Yeah, that's right. If that had happened, I would be giving this talk in Spanish. By the way, the Mexican government was willing to sell, but the deal fell through because at the last minute, a federal court ruled that private citizens could not buy parts of foreign countries. So they went to Plan B, which was to settle the East European Jews in Petaluma. And if you're wondering why it is that, of all places, Petaluma has three generations of East European Jews, it's because the leadership of Temple Emmanuel of San Francisco paid for the chicken feed and the chicken coops and the fertilizer and got them into a outside of the city to a rural area. Now, there were very colorful East European Jewish neighborhoods anyway, the most notable, the Fillmore District, particularly in the 20s and 30s. But the East European Jews, again, were in the shadow of the German Jewish dynastic families that held all of the reins of community leadership more than anywhere else in the United States. Now, what was the religious expression of this German Jewish elite? Their synagogue was Temple Emmanuel. Before 1906, before the earthquake, it was in a magnificent sanctuary on Sutter Street. It's where the medical building 450 Sutter is now. It was ultra-reform. For a while, it held services, Sabbath services, on Sunday. Yeah, I needn't say that's outside the mainstream of Judaism. But more than that, it actually did away with the shofar, the ram's horn, blown in almost every synagogue in the world on the high holidays, replaced the shofar with a trumpet player from the symphony. Now, this Jewish community was admired by the non-Jews. Jews were considered the most philanthropic group in the city, patrons of the arts in particular. They were also the cultural creators, the 19th and early 20th century. They were leading painters and dramatists and musicians and actors. Jews were in the forefront of the California progressive movement at the turn of the century. And it was a Jewish civic leader, Harris Weinstock, who was a founder of the Commonwealth Club and was its first president, Harris Weinstock. Jews were elected to high office. The first Jewish mayor of any American big city was from San Francisco, Adolf Sutro. The city was long represented in Washington by a Jew for three decades, from the end of the 19th century all the way to the mid-1920s. Julius Kahn was the congressman. When he died in 1924, his wife won the seat, Florence Prague Kahn. She was the first Jewish woman in Congress, again, from San Francisco. Jews were corporate titans in the Bay Area. And it wasn't only Levi Strauss, who everyone talks about. Jews like the Fleischackers controlled an empire from the Pacific Northwest to Hawaii to the Philippines. The Slosses and the Gerstles had a virtual monopoly on the natural resources of Alaska. Adolf Sutro owned 1/8 of all the real estate in San Francisco. Now, for all its wealth, Jewish community often embraced issues of social justice. for blacks, for Mexican farm workers, even for Japanese who were interned in the detention camps. But by the 1940s, they seemed to feel little responsibility for their Jewish brethren overseas. The response to the Holocaust of local Jews was very timid. And the Bay Area also produced, again, in the 1940s, the strongest chapter nationwide of the American Council for Judaism, the organization devoted to preventing the creation of a Jewish state. So these were Jews staunchly against Zionism. But that's a thumbnail picture of the community up to the mid-1940s. How has Jewish life changed between then and now? Well, first we must look at the demography. Since the 1940s, many thousands of Jews have arrived in the Bay Area every year. The great majority of them of East European origin, the group that for a century had been underrepresented in San Francisco compared to other American cities. The first post-war wave included veterans of the armed services who had just became enthralled with the natural beauty of the area and wanted to return here. Then there were Holocaust survivors. Many of them sailed directly from Shanghai, which was a wartime refuge. As you know, in the 1960s and 1970s, there was an inflow of young, mostly single Jews, especially to Berkeley and San Francisco. More recently, the newcomers have been established business people and professionals. Since mid-century, the local Jewish community has swelled sevenfold. So in this hugely enlarged post-war community, the German Jews lost the majority status. And more importantly, the East European Jews and their descendants became major philanthropists. This happened only after the war. The first one was the hotel owner Ben Swig. Born in Boston to Lithuanian immigrants, and he reached the highest echelons of lay leadership already by the late 1940s. In more recent decades, potent family foundations were established by philanthropists such as Joseph Corrett, Bernard Osher, Ted Toby, Jim Joseph, Jacques Reutlinger, all born and raised outside the Bay Area, and in most cases, even outside the United States. They have rivaled the pioneer German-Jewish dynasties, epitomized by the magnanimous Haas and Goldman families, which set up mighty foundations as well. So there has been a kind of power sharing, finally. And the result has been that Jewish education, Jewish culture, social services have been supported on an unprecedented scale. Now, since 1945, suburbanization has transformed Jewish life. And that also vaulted many first-generation Bay Area Jews into leadership positions in new synagogues and community centers. Suburbanization has been remarkable. In 1945, over 80% of the Bay Area Jews lived within the city limits of San Francisco or Oakland. Today, that ratio is reversed. Only 20% live within the city limits of San Francisco and Oakland. In the outlying areas, of course, there are vibrant synagogues, Jewish community centers. The South Peninsula is perhaps the best example. As late as 1960, the Jewish population in the South Peninsula was only 5,000. It is today 75,000, outstripping San Francisco's. So the satellite communities reflect a Jewish population ever more widely dispersed and now encompassing 9 counties across 7,000 miles, square miles. In this suburbanized, decentralized Bay Area, where 4 out of every 5 Jewish adults hail from somewhere else. 4 out of every 5 Jewish adults are not Bay Area natives. Part of the distinctiveness, and you could say peculiarities, of pre-war San Francisco Jewry have necessarily disappeared. Moreover, Northern California is, of course, linked with the rest of the country and the rest of the world in ways we could not have imagined. You have visits to Auschwitz or the Western Wall in Israel, or conferences in New York and Washington, and, of course, the revolution in communication with news and opinion on television, online. All these things have blunted the differences among regional Jewish identities throughout the country. So a Southern Jew is no longer as distinctive, even a New York Jew no longer as distinctive as a generation or two ago, because all the Jews of America have the same access to information. The Bay Area, the largely newly arrived population with closer ties to the rest of American and world Jewry, has led to the embrace of basic elements of Jewish life that had been given short shrift in the first century. Now, one of the best examples is a new assertiveness. I mentioned Bay Area Jewry was nearly paralyzed during the Holocaust. Yet by the 1970s and 80s, the community became a national leader in fighting for oppressed Jews. Missions to Ethiopia highlighted the plight of the Falashas. The Bay Area Council for Soviet Jewry held countless vigils and rallies outside the Soviet consulate. You know, soon after his release from the Gulag, Natan Sharansky came here to San Francisco, and he announced that even in a remote prison camp, he knew of the efforts to free him emanating from the Bay Area. Now, non-establishment groups have generally taken the lead in such causes. Today, a local grassroots organization, Jimena, focuses on Jewish refugees from the Middle East and North Africa. But there is also a supportive and coordinating role played by the San Francisco Federation's Jewish Community Relations Council. It bears no resemblance to its pre-war predecessor, which was called the Survey Committee. The Survey Committee was aloof, very narrowly constituted, and astonishingly, it did not even participate in the community-wide rally against the Holocaust in 1943. Now, the attitude toward Zionism has also undergone a sea change. The community that produced the country's most powerful branch of the anti-Zionist American Council for Judaism has emerged as a bulwark of pro-Israel activism. And the most striking example of many would be AIPAC, which this chapter in Northern California is one of the Israel lobby's strongest chapters nationwide. Jewish learning has also reversed course and has become increasingly vibrant in the past 2 generations. The Jewish day school movement is a dramatic example. There were none until the early 1960s, not one Jewish day school. Now, the area's 13 day schools enroll 10% of all the Jewish school children. This reflects a major shift from mid-century when local leaders feared the day schools would ghettoize the Jewish community. Most startling is the change in higher education. Full-scale Judaica programs have mushroomed at 7 local universities. The region now rivals New York and Boston as a center of Jewish scholarship. You know, just in one 18-month-long period, earlier this decade, 3 scholars living in the Berkeley Hills published works that will reverberate for generations. Professor David Beal edited a compendium of 23 scholarly articles exploring Jewish identity from its ancient origins to the present. Daniel Matt produced the first two of a projected 11-volume annotated translation of the Zohar. Professor Robert Alter unveiled a monumental translation of the Torah, one of the greatest ever written in English. Berkeley has become a kind of Vilna by the Bay. And Stanford is not far behind. Yet even as the Bay Area community has moved from the periphery to the center of American Jewish life, strong echoes of the distant past can still be heard. And I turn now to the things that have not changed since 1945. One of these constants during our entire history is the laxity of Jewish religious practice. This alarmed visitors since the Gold Rush, and it has been indicated in contemporary demographic studies. Now, as then, Bay Area Jews light Hanukkah candles, attend Passover Seders, fast on Yom Kippur, but far less frequently than their co-religionists across America. The Orthodox comprise about one-tenth of American Jewry, but they are only 2 to 3% locally. Only 2 or 3% are Orthodox locally. Indeed, the religious profile of the Bay Area has remained very liberal for 160 years. A third of the Jewish households currently identify themselves as secular or non-denominational. An additional 38% identify as Reform. Synagogue affiliation is merely one-fifth of Jewish households. That's less than half the national average. And it calls to mind laments voiced a century ago when membership was even lower. Consistent with its history of religious experimentation, Bay Area Jewry includes many quote-unquote seekers, borrowing from Eastern religions and other beliefs and delving into mysticism and meditation. In recent decades, rabbis such as the late Alan Liu have sought to refresh Jewish prayer by infusing it with Zen Buddhism in particular. And other Jews have turned almost exclusively to Buddhism for their spiritual nourishment. Individuals of Jewish birth have recently led both the San Francisco and the Berkeley Zen centers, where reportedly half the members are Jewish born. Jews have been disproportionately represented in the Hare Krishna movement, Scientology, transcendental meditation, and Est. Neo-paganism, which encompasses witchcraft and earth worship, is currently led in San Francisco by a Jewish-born woman named Starhawk. Now, this calls to mind just the things that I researched in my book from the 19th century. Then, local Jews were choosing alternatives as well. Those alternatives then were ethical culture, theophacy, Christian Science. There were even many Jews who worshiped the Sierra Mountains. Now, we also have seen there continue to be many innovations within Judaism. One of the nation's earliest and most active gay congregations is from here. Country's first Jewish healing center, feminist seders and liturgy, several synagogues devoted primarily to social action. And something else that has its roots in the 19th century, the high profile of women in Jewish life. I found, first of all, women excelled in the professions, Jewish women excelled in the professions in the 19th century. The first female doctor in the state was a Jewish woman. The first female professor at Berkeley was a Jewish woman. The first female lawyer in California was a Jewish woman. I found Jewish women scientists, journalists, novelists, all in the 19th century. And the Bay Area produced the first woman rabbi in America. Rachel Frank Littman in 1890, although she was never formally ordained. Today, women constitute about a third of the Bay Area rabbinate. Women are among the most powerful Jewish communal executives, heading such agencies as the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, Jewish Family and Children's Services, Jewish Vocational Center, both Jewish museums, and the Federation's huge endowment fund. Now, another trend that has continued has been the relatively low level of anti-Semitism in this area, and the plethora of Jews elected to office. Two Bay Area Jewish women were elected to the United States Senate in 1992 without a trace of anti-Semitism. And Jews have been, and they have been reelected multiple times since. Local Jews have distinguished themselves in the House, the state legislature, the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. Success in the business world has been no less impressive. A reprise of the stunning corporate achievements of the community's first century, when Jewish enterprises played a key role in San Francisco's meteoric economic rise. Levi Strauss continues to be a worldwide force in the apparel industry. But in the past generation, we've seen new global businesses that have been created by Jews. The Gap, for example, or in Silicon Valley, Oracle, Intel, Google, among many, many others that I could mention. Local Jews have also excelled in biotechnology, which is so vital to the state. Virtually every major industry in Northern California. They have made their mark in banking and finance and real estate development. And Jewish corporate success has often gone hand in hand with philanthropy and civic mindedness. Again, just one of many, many examples. You remember back in 1989, when the A's and the Giants were doing well, the Bay Bridge World Series. It turned out that Jewish businessmen owned both teams. And in both cases, they bought the teams to prevent them from moving out of town. Jews have also been leading contemporary impresarios in the 19th century. There are many post-war examples. The rock concerts presented by Bill Graham in the Fillmore in the 70s and 80s. Theatrical presentations of productions of Carol Shorenstein Hayes, music and movies of Saul Zentz. It's a very, very long list that I don't have time to include. And then there's the novelty and irreverence of the performers. Again, very much like the 19th century. We have that in the post-war period. The poetry readings by Allen Ginsberg, in North Beach. In the 1950s, or the routines of Lenny Bruce and Mort Saul in the 1960s, currently the riffs of comedian Josh Kornbluth. What I found is an unbroken theme of Jewish nonconformists continuing to thrive in a metropolis celebrating nonconformity. But the accomplished classicism of Isaac Stern or Yehudi Menuhin, both from San Francisco, also continues in the post-war period. Since 1995, the conductor of the symphony has been Michael Tilson Thomas, grandson of the revered Yiddish actor Boris Tomaszewski. The arts have always been central to the very experience of being Jewish in the Bay Area. Today, the San Francisco Jewish Film Festival, it's the oldest and largest in the world. It draws tens of thousands of people annually. For many, it constitutes their primary or even their only Jewish activity. In addition, the region boasts the nationally recognized repertory Traveling Jewish Theater, two major museums, the Magnus in Berkeley, of course, the Contemporary Jewish Museum not far from here, in a spectacular new facility designed by Daniel Libeskind. Now, while the arts have loomed large, the other main preoccupation of Bay Area Jewry since the Gold Rush has been striving for social justice, and that remains in full bloom. In the 1950s, the rabbi of Emmanuel, Alvin Fine, was at the same time the chair of the regional ACLU and also a founder and charter member of the city's Human Rights Commission. Fine's successors at Emmanuel continued to speak out for the disadvantaged. Rabbi Robert Kirshner, in 1985, boldly called attention to the AIDS crisis. And Rabbi Stephen Pierce and his colleagues have helped at-risk inner-city youth, fought hunger and despoiling of the environment. Across the bay in Temple Beth Abraham in Oakland, Rabbi Harold Schulweis focused on economically exploited blacks in his city. Even as our community commemorates the Holocaust each year with elaborate Yom HaShoah ceremonies, Jewish organizations have been in the forefront in deploring apartheid in South Africa and genocide in such places as Bosnia and Darfur. On almost all these issues of social conscience, the Bay Area rabbinate has worked closely with outspoken non-Jews, non-Jewish clergy, and this is also an unbroken line of 160 years. These interfaith bonds are the strongest here of any place in the United States. Now, there also have been Jews who have responded to the call for social action, not because of the synagogue pulpit, but they've responded from secular society. And Jews have, we see this with the free speech movement in Berkeley. More than half of the steering committee of the free speech movement in 1964 were Jews, and a large number of them were children of New York communists. Local Jews also edited left-wing periodicals like Ramparts and Mother Jones. And through demonstrations, petitions, the courts, Jews were advocates for Native Americans, Mexican farm workers. It would be hard to find a progressive cause or a countercultural trend in the Bay Area where Jews were not disproportionately represented. And just to conclude on this point, Jews have been leaders in the movement for gay rights. Harvey Milk, of course, was the first openly gay office holder in the country. See there, as you've learned this evening, there are many firsts here where Jews show up. And in 1978, the shocking tragedy of his assassination, the moving memorial service at Emmanuel, energized many homosexuals. And since then, there have been an increasing number of Jewish gay religious and political leaders in the Bay Area. Roberta Achtenberg is a good example. She was the first openly gay person confirmed by the U.S. Senate for a major post, Assistant Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. And Mark Leno, a former rabbinical student at Hebrew Union College, is currently state senator. As assemblyman in 2005, he was an early advocate of same-sex marriages. So as they have since the 19th century, when they championed the rights of women and children, migrant workers and small farmers, prisoners and prostitutes, Jews in the Bay Area continue to be highly visible on the political frontier. They are often testing limits and igniting controversy. I've picked this up in my research over the entire 160 years. If you think of American Jewry as a house, you can think of Bay Area Jews not as the walls of the house, but the windows, looking out on the world, inclusive, creative artistically, advocating social justice for all in society. And I would add that in the post-war period, Jews have intuited that if the walls fall, woe to the windows, meaning that while they continued to be innovative and experimental and very easygoing religiously, they also are shoring up the basics of Jewish life with more emphasis on Jewish education, oppressed Jewry, and Israel. This corrective is the most important trend of the last 65 years. I think it will put the community in good stead for the extraordinary change that is likely to occur in the future. And I, you heard in my introduction that my task is not only to explain the changes from 1945, but to predict what will happen in the next decade. And that's what I'm about to do here very briefly, and then I'd love to hear from you. What will the next decade look like? Let me briefly address three issues. The current economic downturn, the accelerating rate of intermarriage, and the relationship to an embattled Israel. I think while I've enumerated those, I could almost hear people groaning about how serious all that is. But I am one actually with more hope than despair. Let's start with the weakening economy. I do not believe it necessarily means a decline in the vitality of Jewish life. Even in the depths of the Depression, the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco opened its doors in 1933, the first JCC in the West, and for decades to come, the most vibrant Jewish institution in the city. Sometimes the pressure of fewer dollars can lead to a more rational organization of community agencies. Perhaps it will lead to a merger of the East Bay and West Bay federations, something that could help us overcome the dispersion and decentralization that are such big problems now. We may see the two great local Jewish museums merge again. We may see major synagogues merge as a response to the financial need. Even two famous ones who started in 1851. But Jewish creativity in this region will not wither due to a faltering economy. I hope you've gleaned from this evening that it is an ethos based, it's an ethos 160 years in the making. It's based on the cultural pluralism and the fluid social structure of the Bay Area itself is not going to go away. Now let me turn to the explosive rate of intermarriage. I believe this is also is an opportunity, not a crisis. The Bay Area is better suited to deal with intermarriage than any other area in the country because of its history of inclusiveness, of borrowing from other religious traditions, of stressing the universal elements of Judaism. And I found in my research that people, commentators, were noting the high rate of intermarriage in the 1880s. But even then, they were saying to accept it. And today, about 40% of the area's married Jews have non-Jewish spouses. It's a lot. There are 100,000 non-Jews living in Jewish households. And I know that the intermarriage rate is only going to accelerate as the children of the intermarried marry. They tend to marry non-Jews at very high rates. But it may shrink the size of the community. But in the Bay Area, I think, again, you've learned this evening, in the Bay Area, the Jewish growth rate comes less from natural increase than from an influx from other places. Northern California, because of its quality of life and professional opportunities, will remain attractive to Jews from the East Coast or the Midwest. The Jewish population may not continue to double every 20 years as it has, but the community will not slip below some kind of critical mass. Now, finally, Israel, and I'll conclude my remarks. Its policies, no doubt, will continue to be controversial. And the local Jewish community will itself react with a mixture of defense and dissent. But whatever their politics, the high level of engagement of Bay Area Jews in Israel's social problems will endure. Last year, I was a traveling scholar for the Federation's mission to Israel, marking its 60th anniversary. And I see about a half a dozen people in the audience tonight who are with me on that intense journey. More than 100 people came with us, including Mayor Newsom, by the way. It was different from prior missions, which almost exclusively celebrated the country's achievements and highlighted its security problems. This time, corporate executives from the Bay Area interacted with Israeli leaders in high tech, biotech, and real estate. Another track emphasized the country's social problems, visited projects of the Federation aimed at fighting poverty and illiteracy in Israel, including the Arab sector, by the way, fostering religious pluralism and women's rights. The Bay Area Jewish community is in the forefront nationally in this kind of engagement with Israel. And I think such a partnership can be the basis of a new Zionism for American Jews as a whole. So in the coming decade and beyond, the Bay Area Jewry will continue to be innovative. Its major challenge, though, remains the same: how to adapt to unprecedented freedom. How to resist both assimilation and parochialism. How to exist in a society, as Judah Magnus said 100 years ago, a society that offers the greatest opportunities to Jews but poses the greatest danger to Judaism. In that sense, Jews here are like Jews in the rest of America, only more so. Thank you very much.
Many thanks.
I'm eager to hear your questions, and I understand we can go a few minutes after 7 if we need to.
Yes, we can.
Okay.
Yeah, we have a lot of questions here, and I want to thank you, Fred Rosenbaum, founding director of Layer House Judaica, for your remarks tonight. And before we begin the questions, I do want to recognize two people, if I may, in the audience. Seymour Frommer. I guess you could be considered the real mainstay of the Judah Magnus Museum. Seymour, would you stand so we could recognize you? And also behind him is Stephen Dobbs, I recognize from Corette. So, Stephen, would you stand for a moment, too? Thank you both for being here. This is a good opportunity with Seymour Frommer here to see if we can get a very brief comparison between the two Jewish museums that we have in the Bay Area. I think we could probably do several programs on the history of this, but we have the Contemporary Jewish Museum, and then we also have the Judah Magnus. They're different. Many people say, how can an area like this support two Jewish museums? Maybe you've got a comment, Fred.
Sure.
Careful.
Well, I think that they are serving two different purposes. And, you know, as I alluded to in my remarks, they did merge. That only lasted about a year, though. It's because of there were two different cultures to the museums, you know. One is in Berkeley, and the other one, you know, in downtown San Francisco. There was, I'd say the environment, the feeling, the sensibility of the two were different. But they're serving two different purposes. The Magnus Museum has a tremendous collection, and it is a far older museum, starting in 1962. And I wanted to add to what you mentioned about Seymour Frommer. He is not only founded the museum, but he also founded the Western Jewish History Center. And I want to say that none of my research, my books, would have been possible if at the Western Jewish History Center I didn't have the original documents that Seymour has collected for more than a generation. That is the personal correspondence, the institutional minutes, the run of the periodicals. You can read the equivalent of the Jewish bulletin there, going all the way back to the Gold Rush, the Jewish papers, all the way to the present. So so that museum has that. And of course, it has the greatest collection of Hanukkah menorahs in the world, and many, many other holdings, says the collection. The one here, though, This is in downtown San Francisco. It has the magnificent building, and it has the spotlight shines on it. You know, the more the tourists are here, and it's a more central location, and it has the outstanding changing exhibits that can come from New York or elsewhere. So they are really serving two different purposes. Nevertheless, this is interesting, isn't it, about the nature of Bay Area Jewry? Maybe this has occurred to some of you as I've been speaking. We do not have a rabbinical seminary here, even though we're the third largest Jewish community in the country and the sixth largest in the world. There's no rabbinical seminary. There are two Jewish museums. What does this tell you about the emphasis of the community? And I found this from the Gold Rush on. The arts are so central, even to being a Jew in the Bay Area. And I think that duality of the museums or the strength of the museums reflects that. Okay, let's have the next question.
Okay, well, you've written several books, Architects of Reform, Congregational and Co. What does co mean? Company? And Visions of Reform, both books that you read, and they're really about Reform Judaism.
Yes.
And they center on Temple Emmanuel.
Yes.
You do not talk about, I haven't been able to find anywhere, about Temple Sherith Israel, which started out as an Orthodox synagogue in San Francisco. But that's really a lead-in to my real popper here. And I know the answer to this question, and someone asked, are there more Jews in L.A. or San Francisco? It's obviously L.A. L.A. is also the home to the center of Kabbalah in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a Kabbalah center here in the Bay Area?
That is nothing like that one in L.A. because they, appeal to all of the celebrities, film celebrities. But there's much more of much more serious inquiry here in terms of Jewish spirituality. L.A. has that Kabbalah center, and Madonna goes there, and so on. I would rather have Daniel Matt, who is the world's expert on Kabbalah and Zohar here, who's sitting in Berkeley and translating the Zohar, the 11-volume annotated text. So I'd say the inquiry is much more serious, what's done here. May I ask, why did you start with Sherith Israel? I don't...
Well, I'm thinking of religious institutions.
Okay, well, I'll say a word about that. I have a great deal in my forthcoming book on Sherith Israel. You're right, I wrote two books on Emmanuel. One of the questions that I thought you were going to mention, because this is asked so often, which is the first congregation? Since, each of them claim to be the first. That rivalry has gone on also for 160 years. And in my research, I found found the answer. They were both born at the same time. The first high holiday services were 1849. Shows you how early. The Gold Rush pioneers themselves had high holiday services then. By 1851, groups fewer than the people here tonight came together to form the first synagogue, just a couple dozen people. And would you believe they couldn't agree on the liturgy, and the prayers and so on. And so one group left in a huff and walked out. And so the birth of the first synagogue yielded twins. And Sherith Israel and Emmanuel were born in the same week, April of 1851. So don't let either one claim to be the first. Now, when I was at the Magnus Museum doing my research, I found... Let me preface this. All of the minutes of Emmanuel were destroyed in the earthquake in 1906 when, it came down in the earthquake and the fire. But there are minutes of Sherith Israel. Sherith Israel withstood the earthquake. We have the whole record. And when I was there at the Magnus, I was able to get the first volume of the whole run of the minutes of Sherith Israel. This is like a ledger book, handwritten. To me, this was like the holy grail, the history of our community. And it starts off and it says, mentions a few people meeting in a storefront on April 1851. Somebody went back in another color ink with another handwriting, changed the 51, changed the 1 to a 0, to make it 1850 so that they could claim to be the oldest one.
Clever, these
okay,
Jews.
Okay, go ahead.
Very clever. Well, there must be more than one, possibly, congregants of Temple Emmanuel here. And so here's the question from the audience. At the beginning of the Soviet Jewry movement, the Emmanuel members were not supportive of speaking out for the Jews of the Soviet Union. They were the last to join the movement.
Yes.
Yeah. Can you explain why?
Well, I think they've needed an education all along, but they finally do come around. I think it's much more significant. Recall what I said about Zionism. I mentioned that our community, sadly, generated the anti-Zionist American Council for Judaism, and that was centered at Temple Emmanuel. This was this came out of that mindset of that the German Jewish dynastic families with roots in the Gold Rush, and they did a number of wonderful things. Much of their record is very, very positive, but they were out of touch with the needs of world Jewry. In 1943, in the middle of the Holocaust, the Rabbi of Emmanuel, in his famous sermon, "Where Do You Stand?" Kol Nidre, said that Zionism was the biggest danger facing the Jewish people. And of the 24 members of the board of directors of Temple Emmanuel, 23 were members of the American Council for Judaism. The one dissenter, by the way, was Madeline Haas Russell. Some of you knew her. But then things changed, and I think you can see that after 1945, the community took, or in 1948 in this case, some extent it took until 1967, the community changed. Rabbi Alvin Fine, who replaced that rabbi of 1943, his name was Reichert, Rabbi Fine came in 1948, he was a staunch labor Zionist. And it took a lot, but gradually the community changed. And now many of the German Jewish families, from even with roots in the Gold Rush, are leading Zionists. And so it took a while, and it was necessary, for this dialogue and this debate to take place in our community. They came around. The same thing with the press Jewry and Soviet Jewry as well. So, I'm thankful for that.
There's another question here on possibly the change in the way services are conducted. Reform synagogue services now appear to be, according to this questioner, what we used to call conservative. For example, there's more use of Hebrew now in Reform.
Yes.
Are there any true Reform entities at this time in San Francisco?
Yes, there are. And again, Temple Emmanuel is such a classic example of this. That's for many, many decades, even after the war, there was just the Reform service that could have been like the 19th century. Maybe some of you remember the services of Rabbi Joseph Asher with the organ and very methodical and almost everything in English, and that kind of service. What you have, though, now is, and my last book on Temple Emmanuel, I really stress this, there's been a turn in the temple where there's now a multiplicity of services. They have four rabbis, and they can have different services. So they have some of the services are, you could call it, like conservative, but you could say it has much more Hebrew, it has singing, it has a guitar, it's like a service that you would find anywhere, across the country, even in other Reform congregations in the suburbs or a conservative congregation. So that's a very, very big, very important change. But the classical Reform service still remains in Emmanuel. If you go at 5:30 on Friday night or even Saturday morning, Cantor Roz Barak with her operatic, wonderful operatic voice. That's one of the few places left, certainly in the West, but anywhere really, where you still have that authentic Reform service that bears a lot in common, has a lot in common with the Reform service at the turn of the century, the 19th century. So you still do have that. Mm-hmm. It's just that now you have that plus, services that are you'd expect to find in other synagogues across the country.
Fred, I wonder if Jews in the Bay Area are a little more less visible than in some areas. And I make that statement, it's not a conclusion, based on the next two questions. This person feels or states, why did the Jews in the Bay Area not object more strongly to the Holocaust?
Yeah.
Number one. And number two, do you think that the historical low level of anti-Semitism, and I think these
yes.
questions are interrelated,
yeah.
is correlated with the historically low religious practice of Bay Area Jews?
Mm-hmm. No, that's very interesting. Let me just say a word about the response to the Holocaust. And again, that's that pre-1945 mindset that doesn't exist now. That's really the most shameful part of our whole history. We were so late in responding to the Holocaust. Almost every city in America had protests against the Holocaust, big rallies. In San Francisco, it was delayed and delayed and delayed. It finally took place in June of 1943, which was quite late in this. 9 months earlier, Rabbi Stephen Wise announced that the Nazis had already killed 2 million Jews and they were on their way to killing all the rest of the Jews of Europe. But all that time was lost. Finally comes the protest rally, the Civic Auditorium. Very, very few of the establishment Jews participated in that. No one from Temple Emanuel participated. No one from the Jewish Community Relations Council, then called the Survey Commission, participated in it. And even the rally itself was not as effective as it could have been. Who was the keynote speaker? Now, you can imagine the gravity of the moment. The keynote speaker was Eddie Cantor. You know, the comedian from that time that kind of trivialized the event. They did have Thomas Mann, you know, the great German author. But he tried to apologize for the German people, and he actually claimed in his speech that the German army was going to go on strike against Hitler. It's obviously more than a little wishful thinking. So this was part of that mindset, and I've thought about it quite often. They were just out of touch with the, you know, because the 9 decades of experience up to that point were so positive. They had such prosperity. They had such admiration from the non-Jews. They had such freedom. They were out of touch with the rest of world Jewry. And that's, that's the reason that this happened. But I don't think that the lack of religiosity here, relative lack of it, is the reason for the low level of anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. I think that comes from something else. I think it comes from a general feeling in the Bay Area of toleration and, especially in the religious sphere. You know, there has been a lot of bigotry, but it's almost always been racial in the Bay Area, not religious. You know, think of the ferocious attacks on the Asians in the late 19th century, or, you know, the Mexicans even from the Gold Rush driven off their mining claims, or, you know, blacks were even enslaved in parts of California. The way the Filipinos have been treated, the Native Americans were virtually exterminated. So it's not that, but all that's racial. Religiously, somehow, there is not the doctrinal edge here that there is in other parts of the country. We have a kind of ethnic mix and religious mix that's like, you know, Yugoslavia, but we have a toleration that's like Holland, you know, where people religiously really respect one another. And I, you know, one of the reasons for that, I think, and I'll just end on this when we get to the next question, just a thought, maybe some of you have your own ideas for this. If you think about it, California is one of the few places where, especially Northern California, no one religion dominated, as was the case in other parts of the United States. You know, like the Southern Baptists or the mainline Protestants in the Northeast or even the Mormons in Utah. We never, since the Spanish missions, there has never been one single religion that dominated here. And I think that allowed for a kind of religious pluralism. It's like, as one sociologist has put it, this is God's aquarium, you know, with all kinds of fish swimming around of all different types. So another observer said that somehow as you get past the 100th meridian, you know, and come out west, religion just loses its sharp edge. And I think there is something to that. But go ahead. I'm learning a lot from these questions.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the point in the program where there's time for just one last question. I should say the formal part of the program. Fred Rosenbaum will be staying to answer your questions. I'm going to leave these as I depart. I will be leaving some questions, written questions, for him. And you may please just raise your hand at that point and ask whatever questions you want. But you wrote a book recently, or let me back up.
Okay.
I grew up in Oakland, and I still live in Oakland. And Gertrude Stein is from Oakland. You wrote a book about Gertrude Stein. Could you give us a little summary of that wonderful lady?
Right. It was actually, it's a part of I've written about her in both my first book on the history of the Jews of Oakland, and then in this forthcoming book, I have quite a bit on Gertrude Stein. I just, very briefly, again, she's an example of someone who I think could have only come out of the Bay Area, you know, in her, first of all, her quirkiness, her courage, her unusual lifestyle. It shows, again, how women were so visible, so much in the forefront, how, you know, they didn't compromise, their goals, their dreams. She left the Bay Area in the 1890s to go to Harvard. It wasn't even Radcliffe. There wasn't even Radcliffe then. She went to Harvard. She went to Johns Hopkins Medical School. This alone was remarkable, that a woman would set her sights so high. I found, by the way, in 1896, six female Jewish physicians in San Francisco. That is remarkable. That was a profession that was almost closed to women, just before that. Anyway, as you know, Gertrude Stein spent almost her whole life, her adult life, in Paris. She came back to the Bay Area only once with Alice Toklas. But she wrote many, many times that the Bay Area formed her aesthetic sensibility. Hiking with her brother Leo in the East Bay Hills, seeing the sunsets there, being exposed to all sorts of culture, she would, she'd go over to San Francisco where she'd see great paintings on display. She and her family were trilingual. They spoke French and German at home as well as English. They played classical music at home. They grew up with a marvelous cultural inheritance, but also a love of the great outdoors. It was just a marvelous training, a marvelous preparation for someone who would be at the center of almost every avant-garde movement in the arts in the 20th century. She and her family, her brother Leo, her brother Michael, and her sister-in-law Sarah, Michael's wife, those four were called by the Paris art critics the Stein Corporation. And they fostered the clash of the titans, the polarity between Matisse and Picasso early in the 20th century. The Steins bought almost the entire output of Matisse for several years. And, of course, you know, Picasso's portrait of Gertrude, that's considered one of the 10 greatest works that the Metropolitan Museum of New York has. So this is a world-class figure, but she really is rooted in the Bay Area, in the East Bay. She went to Temple Sinai religious school in Oakland. Her classmate was Judah Magnus, the same Sunday school class. Their teacher was that person who became the first American woman rabbi, Rachel Frank Littman. These were the kind of people that came out of there. And I'll just end with this one thing. It was said of Magnus, but it's true of Gertrude Stein as well. Both of them left California early, you know, But they had California with them. They brought, you know, whether it was to New York, to Israel, to Paris, they brought with them the sense of the audacious freedom of the American West. I'll close with that. Thank you.
Thank you. Many, many thanks to Fred Rosenbaum, the founding director of Lehrer House Judaica, for his remarks tonight. And I want to thank all of you in the audience for attending. I'd also like to give special thanks to the JCRC, the Jewish Community Relations Council, for their support of tonight's program. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you.